in. Down on creation, and the only explanation I can find is the love that I've found ever since you've been around. Your love's put me at the top of the world.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The BBC News at 5 o'clock. This is Richard Lawson. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the killing of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah has settled the score. He described his death in an Israeli airstrike on Beirut on Friday as a historic turning point. Iran, a key ally of Hezbollah, has declared a 5-day mourning period and called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. Our international editor Jeremy Bowen says the decisions taken over the next few days could determine whether the conflict spirals into a wider war, with Hezbollah damaged but not defeated.
It still has experienced fighters, it still has weapons. How the people who are there now after him decide to use those, what their allies in Iran decide to do, and the way Israel decides to try to follow up the success it's had so far. All that shorter term could lead to a wider Middle East war. Longer term, it could even reshape the region.
The Kent MP Rosie Duffield has resigned from the Labour Party because of what she called the government's cruel policies. In her resignation letter, she accused Sir Keir Starmer of hypocrisy for accepting gifts from donors while cutting winter fuel payments to millions of pensioners in England and Wales. There's been no response from Downing Street yet. Our correspondent Damian Grammaticus has more details.
Rosie Duffield told the BBC she believed Sir Keir Starmer cared more about greed and power than making a difference. A resignation letter was deeply critical of the Prime Minister for his leadership, calling it uninspiring. His policy of cutting winter fuel support, saying it's cruel and unnecessary, and his accepting of gifts, calling it avarice off the scale. Speaking to Sunday with Laura Kunzberg, she said it was profoundly disappointing. There's no sign other Labour MPs plan to follow her. Reactions from them have ranged from regret she's gone to criticism that she had not already been suspended by the party.
Meanwhile, the Conservatives' annual conference will begin in Birmingham later today, where the focus will be on the party leadership contest. The four candidates will all use the conference to argue their case before two more are voted out of the race. Three people have been charged with murdering a man who was stabbed in Norwich last week. The body of Calvin Taylor, who was 19, was found in a flat last Saturday. Football now, and Chelsea's Cole Palmer has made Premier League history, becoming the first ever player to score four goals in the first half of a match. Chelsea's game against Brighton finished 4-2, with the 22-year-old disappointed that he didn't score even more.
Yeah, I just try to play every game best as I can and hopefully pull off performances like that today. Should have had five or six. We got a lot more chances and I just took the...
To the weather forecast now, a dry but chilly start, which will become wetter and windier as a patch of heavy rain moves in from the southwest. And that's the BBC News. The time now is coming up to 5:03.
You've probably got a list of things your child needs for uni. Pans, cutlery, sheets, duvet, towels, you know. But this is a little reminder that they'll also need a TV licence to be covered to watch all the TV channels, live TV on streaming services and BBC iPlayer. On the downside, it's one more thing on your list. On the upside, you can continue to enjoy your favourite shows together on the family group chat. And they won't be bringing it home to be washed either. To find out more, search TV licence uni.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Adam Fleming. I present the Newscast podcast, which is available every weekday on BBC Sounds. But every weekend, I'm going to be here on 5 Live, bringing you some of our best bits. So why don't you sit back and listen to some of the most interesting chats that have been on this week's editions of Newscast.
Newscast.
Newscast from the BBC.
I like landscapes.
You have a bright future behind you.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree?
We're effectively run in this country by a bunch of childless cat ladies.
You don't understand the essence of Brad.
It's the fun police working overtime. It's just getting silly now.
Take me down to Downing Street. Let's go have a tour.
Blimey.
In today's episode, you're going to hear an extended conversation between me, Mariana Spring, BBC disinformation and social media correspondent, and Matt Jukes, who is the head of counter-terrorism policing in the UK. He's assistant commissioner at the Metropolitan Police. And he wanted to talk to us at length about his work, about what the police have been doing, about the interaction between the riots we had in the UK earlier in the summer and social media, and just how the social media companies operate and whether they're regulated enough. And it's a very interesting conversation from somebody you don't hear from a lot. So we thought we would give that plenty of space. Assistant Commissioner, hello.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you.
Welcome to the Newscast Fake Living Room. Now, you guys don't do interviews a lot. I mean, I'm not accusing you of like hiding from the media. You do communicate. But I just wondered why you wanted to kind of sit down and have a big chat with us today.
I think we're at a point in time where we've got a really extraordinary collision of factors. You know, we've seen over the last 12 months, enormous amount of that polarisation people are experiencing in communities and online, obviously after the 7th of October and then through the disorder in August. So that's definitely one factor for us, which is very much in mind. We've definitely got an upturn in terrorist risk associated with some of those driving forces, and we're concerned about that. And then we're at a moment in time where the world's in this really difficult condition, with two wars that are at the front of everybody's minds affecting security here, hostile state actions which are also present. And you kind of loop all the way back to the start of that, and actually those hostile state actors also interested in driving division in our country itself. So it feels like a time where we need to talk to the public more about those risks, but also talk about the way we're responding so people can understand we're doing that, and see the ways in which the public can help, because the reality is we're sort of all in this together, really. And, you know, as we go on to talk about things like the experience online, we get an enormous amount of insight into that from working with the public, as we always have. So I hope that, you know, we'll be able to unpack a few of those things. But, you know, really, I think a really challenging time across the world, and you pull a string anywhere in the world and it tugs that thread here in the UK.
And this is all happening on social media. It's like social media has put rocket boosters under. I mean, we've had these sorts of issues before. They've existed in society for centuries, for decades. But social media is the thing that's given it rocket boosters.
I think, yeah, I mean, there's a combination of the overt social media. So if we, you know, look at what's happened in the summer, in the disorder, but also in our terrorist casework, you've got the combination of the overt social media and then closed messaging apps, and really some of those are not that closed. So you look at the scale of the groups involved, they're sort of quasi platforms in their own right. That's the big connector, and that's why we see things like children involved in terrorism. I mean, I've been in and out of this work for over 20 years. We would never have seen 12 and 13 year olds exposed to the kind of things they're now exposed to. Yet social media, messaging apps, that connectivity are really impacting in homes, in communities, and as we've seen over the summer on the streets.
So 12-year-olds,
yeah,
any younger than that, or is that? I mean, 12 is pretty young, but
I mean, so we see our work through a number of lenses. In investigations, we see children as young as 12 and 13. If I put that a sense of scale on it, one in five of the people we arrest for terrorism are children under 18.
Right.
So that's a really significant number, over 200, you know, in the last year of terrorist arrests, of which that one in five, as I say, are children. So that's a concern. But in the space of people raising their concerns about young people, which is about half of the 6,000 or 7,000 people who get referred to us through that route, that is a really significant feature of people even under 10. Getting referred in through those systems. Now, we're not suggesting those kids are terrorists, of course, but what it means is people know they're being exposed to that content.
And when we think back to the summer and the disorder that unfolded, we were in touch with each other about kind of, oh, hang on, what's being shared on social media here? I know it's something that your team look at, and there's a specific team that exists.
Yes, yeah.
Could you tell newscasters a little bit about that? What is that team that looks at social media content that could be linked with violence, terror, disorder?
So we have a team called the CT, the Counterterrorism Internet Referral Unit. We take referrals particularly from members of the public. We take them from platforms as well. And that happens every day of the week. So we're receiving concerns about online content.
And how do people get in touch with you?
So in relation to the disorder, we had about 1,200 referrals of content, and since the 7th of October, about 4,500. So to give a sense of scale, I mean, we're getting thousands and thousands of contacts from the public, and the same on the hotline we have available. The really stark thing is, I mean, there's two features from the period of the summer. The one is just the disproportionate effect of certain platforms in the way that they're referred to us. So, of course, we know there are certain platforms that have got, you know, really significant reach. But we saw 13 times more referral from the public in relation to X, Twitter, than TikTok. Two platforms with enormous reach, but very different in terms of the way the public viewed their content. So that is really clear. And the other thing which is clear is the public are not bad at seeing what they or understanding what they see and describing what is of most concern. So you would think we were getting a lot of referrals and material that might be marginal or might be a difference of political opinion. We get some of that, of course. But when we look back across the period since the 7th of October and 4,500 items referred to us, about one in three of those need our attention. So the public are actually very good at spotting, you know, we're living our lives online, aren't we? So people are used to seeing fractious debate, but this is the material people have felt they needed to bring to the attention of the authorities.
Yeah, it's not just people seeing an argument online. It's something that they think is verging into terrorism activity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've seen, you know, I think what we saw during the disorder is similar to, in many ways, to what we see in our counterterrorism casework. And, you know, Adam, you pointed out, we don't talk about that a lot. But here, you know, there are connecting features. Why do people go online? To incite other people to get involved, to identify targets of potential violence, the disorder, the terrorism, and to spread misinformation. And those things are happening at volume and at scale. So, you know, those numbers I've talked about, thousands, are clearly tip of the iceberg stuff in terms of what's happening. And that's why, you know, we have real concerns about the online space and our ability to make any impact on it.
How did you go about dealing with this kind of content that was being referred in during the riots in particular? You know, because, you know, a lot of people will be thinking, well, hang on a second, a lot of that content we imagine isn't being classed necessarily as terror. Is it disinformation? Is it hate? How do you deal with the stuff that doesn't cross the line of being in breach of terror legislation?
So there's two principal things that happen, three really, and unfortunately the third is that people may take no action at all. But the two things that are most constructive are either we're identifying material which is clearly terrorist content. We're going to investigate that. We route that material into teams who can get behind the anonymity of those, you know, of those online posts. And then we get the platforms to take down. And the takedowns for some material are reasonably successful. So they're plainly illegal. So if you give an example of something we've seen a lot of tragically over the years, the Christchurch mosque attack, which was live streamed and recorded, proliferated online. The online platforms are good at taking that down. In fact, they detect it automatically largely now and take it down. The messaging platforms, less so, because some of them don't pay any attention really to the content of, you know, that is there or it's encrypted. So we do get takedowns. We've got investigations. And then the other threshold is terms of service or terms of conditions. And we do, you know, it's fair to say we've made progress in this respect. And some of the platforms...
Basically the term of service, you sign up to
it. You've signed up to it. And so major platforms are taking steps to remove that content, which, particularly the content which is illegal. The harder part is the content which, you know, sometimes described as lawful but awful. You know, the material which is in a grey space between being illegal and being, you know, free speech point. So terms and conditions help us a lot. They help even more if the platforms have terms and conditions that they really operate to. So clearly there are a number of platforms which are getting harder. I've described how X is an enormous driver of what we've seen over the summer. And in the case of the disorder after the terrible incidents in Southport, Telegram was an enormous part of the engine for that. And so in that case, we saw more than 10,000 people in one Telegram group. And I mean, a lot of people will know this anyway, but you know, Telegram has got 900 million users and about 100 employees with an absolute, you know, cast iron determination to not engage. I know they've said something more recently about shifting a little in this respect, but a sense that they have made their brand that they won't be involved with authorities. So a real distinction between platforms and their conduct, and definitely progress with some and less with others.
When you talk about X and the changes at X and the role that X played in what happened during the summer, the posts on the site, have they been receptive to you? Do you have communication with X?
I mean, we have communication with all the platforms, and responsiveness varies really depending on what the content is. If it's that clearly over the line illegal content, then definitely we see a change. And, you know, now at the risk of getting out of my lane, we know there's a huge freedom of speech conversation taking place on X, and clearly you know, its owner saw this disorder and our responses as part of that discussion. It became another, you know, another part of the narrative there about the suppression, if you like, of free speech. But I suppose, you know, I would say this to Elon Musk if he was here, you know, people have exposed their views, have shared their views, have developed their views on a whole range of issues on X over the years. And that includes questions like immigration. That's not what we were out arresting, or my colleagues, I should say, in local police forces and regional organised crime units, were not out arresting people for having opinions on immigration. They went out and arrested people for threatening to or inciting others to burn down mosques or hotels. So it's that kind of content which was present. And the other feature, of course, of the last period has been the way that's been accelerated and put on steroids by algorithms and bots. So I pay attention to some of this stuff on my feeds because I'm interested professionally. I now can't stop seeing it because it's just getting, so I dread to think what your feeds are
like. My feed's terrible.
So you know, because you're just getting pushed all of
mine's a lot of Chapel Roan at the moment.
So you're, I mean, that's, you're just right, different Adam. Worlds. I investigate too much horrible stuff. Yeah. My algorithm's a bit of a mess.
So I definitely, you know, that what we saw in the, and what colleagues who, you know, working in local policing saw during the disorder was quite a number of people who actually posted and have ended up being arrested, and some have been prosecuted. You've seen, you know, people who've been sentenced significantly, really. I mean, deterrent, but didn't think that would happen to them at the moment they did. Those small number of people, it's only about 5% of the total number of people who were arrested were for online offences, but their effect has kind of been put on steroids by the bots and the algorithms that are projected here. And then these sort of quasi-news sites, the Channel 3 Now and so on, that have just amplified the messages. So no one ever thought you would get that audience sat wherever you were typing away. But consequences have been very real, of course, haven't they? And we've seen some of that contribute to the violence.
You mentioned Channel 3 Now there, which is this pseudo site. I tracked down some of the people behind it and revealed how it appeared to be a commercial operation looking to get clicks and views, make money. There were quite a few other accounts. I also tracked down people who, again, looked to be kind of growing their following, getting traction. When it comes to Channel 3 Now, the people I found weren't based here in the UK, but elsewhere, including Pakistan. Also someone who appeared to be a Nova Scotian hockey player. How do you deal with that when social media doesn't have borders, but policing kind of does? Yeah. I guess you can extradite people, but like, how does that work? How difficult is that to deal with?
So it's much more challenging for the platforms that are based, I mean, almost all of them, of course, are based outside the UK, but for users who are based outside the UK, it's much more challenging. I mean, there's an international effort in this respect to try to control the greatest risks. And I think this is where regulation really has a role. I mean, we're all engaged in this balance between, even in a job like mine, I worry about the balance between freedom and security and prosperity. All those things they're important dynamics, aren't they? But it's a job for governments coming together really to deal with that question. I think from a law enforcement perspective, from an intelligence community perspective, we work together really hard across the partnerships you would expect in Europe, further afield, the Five Eyes partnerships. They're all a part of us tackling the online threats. But in some ways, the sources of that misinformation and some of it disinformation, the sources are so numerous, we're never going to police our way out of that challenge, and it's got to be dealt with.
Well, so it's unsolvable.
I don't know. I don't think it is unsolvable. I think it's unsolvable by dealing with it after it's happened, downstream of the opportunities that exist elsewhere. So responsible ownership in industry, really active governments who can work out what that integration of security and prosperity and freedoms is, get some consensus on that around the world. And then I think there's something also about, you know, right back in our hands, in classrooms, homes, on the street, we've all got to work out how to actually deal with this information as well. So, you know, I mean, again, you know, well beyond what policing can do, but, you know, so much of what we see is really impacting young people, young boys as well, particularly, and could probably say more about the role really of misogyny in a lot of the content we see. But it's definitely true that, you know, there's a piece here which is about equipping people to deal with information in the age we live in.
What I'm not clear about is, obviously, people condemn misogyny and the hatred of women, but how does hating women and making rape threats, for example, how does that become terrorism?
So we see two things that are overlapping. The first is that it's used in existing terrorist ideologies. So a lot of terrorist ideologies are about superiority. They're either about describing superiority, so male superiority will be a part of that, or they're about saying there's some other group in society that's getting a better deal than you are. You've been left behind. A lot of terrorist mindset spins on that. So a strong anti-feminist rhetoric, you know, it's because of women having more rights that you're in such a bad place now. So we see that in the extreme right wing, the neo-Nazis who talk about the ideal Aryan wife. And then we've seen, of course, internationally, the suppression of women's rights to education, to healthcare and others used as a way of controlling not just women, but controlling the whole population. So it's a feature of terrorist ideologies to diminish women's rights and to dehumanize people. And then, of course, we've also seen a growing number of cases, not many, but a growing number of cases where it is directly that the incel mindset, which is a feature. So it's not a very large part of our casework. And in the last years, we've seen that go from, in our prevention work, we've seen it go from no cases coming to us to about 80 cases a year. But it's definitely something we're paying attention to. But I think critically, it's been there all along in the ideologies that already exist. The other thing we see, which is linked to violence against women and girls, is the presence of domestic abuse in our casework. So about one in three of the people who get put into our prevention routes have got exposure to domestic abuse. That's either because they've been victims and witnesses, they're traumatised by that, or they're perpetrators. So there's a strong collision here of these factors.
And when it comes to the social media companies themselves, we've spoken about Channel 3 Now, for example, and they said that they didn't mean to share the fake name after the Southport attack, and lots of their profiles have now been deleted. There are other people who posted stuff. They also said they regretted, then were arrested but not charged, and so on. But it feels like there's a lot of those people, and we often focus on those people, I guess, because we kind of can, and they tell us something about how this works, but it doesn't feel as though you can arrest all of those people and say, right, okay, it's all solved now. What would you want to see from the social media companies, I guess, thinking about algorithms, thinking about how people get drawn into this content or incentivized to post it, that could make it less of a problem further down the line?
Yeah, so I think part of it does lie back in those terms and conditions. So if they, you know, if they set their thresholds and moderate it, that's an enormous contributor to the overt space. So, you know, if you've got 900 million users,
which is Telegram, you're referring to.
It's Telegram. And only 100 members of staff, how on earth are you going to make an impact on the content? And I'm not talking about people reading messages or moderating individual content. I'm talking about people having the technology to identify the hateful material. I don't just mean terrorism, indecent images of children, all of those other things that are online. You know, you have to have the engineers to build systems. And
I mean, what would be an appropriate number of people working at Telegram to do all that?
I mean, I'm sure it's more than 100. And, you know, if you look at the benchmarks with other organizations, you can see how they've stepped that up. But I definitely think you can build this, you can build better safety into the systems themselves. And probably in the end, that is the place that the algorithms to decentralize the projection. I mean, you get rewarded, don't you? It's all sort of dopamine stuff at one level. People are getting rewarded for the engagement they're getting on, and then they're getting pushed more content.
So you reckon there are some quite simple tweaks could be done to these kind of black box algorithms that just mean that is less likely to be served to you, that stuff?
I mean, the fact you can see more control on some platforms than others demonstrates the fact it's definitely possible. The other thing, which is a real challenge, and you know, in one sense, of course, I'm very concerned. You'd expect me to be pretty hawkish on the questions. I'm concerned with security. I am concerned with the questions about that being legitimate. But total end-to-end encryption, which exists on some of the platforms, is also a major challenge. And the reality is, it's like running a nightclub and saying we're going to switch the CCTV off because we don't want to see what happens inside, and we definitely don't want a record of it. If you go to complete end-to-end encryption, you're basically taking your hands off any sense that you're responsible for the content. Now, I don't want to be part of a state that can see, of course I don't want to be part of a state that can see everything that's passing through those pipelines. But I do want people to think about the technology that would sit on top of those pipelines to detect when indecent images of children or terrorist content is passing through it. So finding our right balance with encryption and privacy is also definitely a part of it. And these are technical industry questions which need governments behind them as well.
So you're not calling for the end of end-to-end encryption. You're calling for there to be like an extra layer of technology on top of the encrypted messages that spots really bad stuff.
Yeah, I mean,
my message to my mate about going to the pub would still be encrypted. It only then gets flagged if there's something awful that I've also posted in there.
Yeah, I mean, we want to know that there are mechanisms to make sure people can be safe in their online use, that people can be disrupted in their really awful online use. And I mean, we talked a bit about numbers. And I know people worry about, and we hear this from particular political perspectives. This summer, it's been about, what's described as far right, and people saying, I'm not allowed to have an opinion on this topic anymore, and I'm at risk of some kind of thought police diving in. I mean, the reality is I'm currently overseeing 800 counterterrorism investigations. We have plenty enough work to do pursuing terrorists. You know, we don't need to be in the space of pursuing people who have opinions, and we don't really want and I don't think any of us who are involved in security want the companies to be constraining that, because actually it would be counterproductive. If people don't have an outlet for their opinions and don't feel they can express that, that can build the sense of grievance. And we've seen examples of that. You do need to let people have a rant. We don't need to necessarily endorse or provide platforms for people to advocate burning down mosques, for example. But I think we can, and the way I've described, I think the public can actually distinguish between those things. So sometimes we suggest this is incredibly complex, grey, where's the boundary question. In a lot of what we see, it really isn't. And you could systematise some of that, you could engineer some of that. And in the end, we're all going to have to work out how to live in a world where it's coming at us.
Do you think that, after the riots happened in the summer, quite a few people said to me, oh, Mariana, this is a watershed moment. It's a moment where everyone realises the real world consequences of what is shared on social media, something I've been banging on about for quite a while. And it's going to make a difference. And, maybe it means this kind of thing won't happen again. What do you think of that? Do you think that there has been enough accountability after the riots for everyone involved, whether that's the people posting stuff or the companies themselves, to ensure that that doesn't happen again in the same way?
The very sharp end of the accountability must have been felt. I mean, my brilliant, brave colleagues in frontline policing and regional units who went out and, confronted the violence, over 1,500 arrests, have delivered accountability. We've seen people getting some you know, the whole criminal justice system, actually, which is straining, but did step up at this time. And you've seen that with people getting 3-year sentences for their online posting. So in a way, the people who are right at the end of this have paid the highest price, really, at this sense. There's no, I'm not suggesting any media executive should be, you know, in prison as a consequence, but the very
I think I'll pull back from
that proposition. But the reality is, isn't it, that all of those people who were able to project their hate, you know, it's only about 5% of the arrests were made, but with a massively disproportionate effect on the events and people's sense of safety. See this all the time in our work. They've seen the impact of that. But the people who make billions from providing those opportunities have not really paid any price at all. I know that, and of course we've talked to government. I know that we're really paying attention to the new online safety legislation, Online Safety Act, relatively new, hasn't really bitten yet. It's rolling out over time. I would definitely like to see that go harder, faster to have its effect. But it's headed in the right direction.
In terms of what? So, okay, faster. I mean, we know that Ofcom are now doing all their consultations on the new codes of practice, and that won't be in place until the spring. So a long time after the legislation's even been passed. But that's the faster bit. But what's the harder bit?
So I think some
extra bits.
I think there was some attrition in the, I mean, you know, without getting too parliamentary nerdy, you know, in all
you're
of
in,
this.
I
think there was some attrition in the passing of the bill of some, particularly around this awful but lawful content that could have made a difference. And I think some of the impact of content on children is understated in the way that the way the practice may develop.
So Conservative MPs who watered down the Online Safety Act because they were worried about free speech and giving a future Home Secretary the power to say that something that is legal to say but harmful for society, giving that the Home Secretary the power to clamp down on that, they've made the country less safe as a result.
I think there's a debate to having it happened in Parliament, which is the place these debates should happen. The point I would want to make is, after a summer like the one we've had, and Mariani, you know, is this a watershed moment? If we can't take this moment to say, do we want to revisit some of those debates and some of those conversations? And there's a...
And you think we should?
I think we should. There's a broad...
Safety Act 2 or an amendment to the existing one? Or?
Some version of that. And of course, as you pointed out, Adam, there's consultation on guidance and application. And then it's about, you know, our collective nerve to hold people to account for that. Is it a watershed? It ought to be. But like in the last 2 weeks, you know, I could point to... an anti-vax conspiracy theorist who's just been convicted of terrorism offences. His reach online through Telegram, in that case, 26,000 people. Another individual, Holocaust denier, was also targeting the LGBT community, just convicted. His reach through the groups he was in, 28,000 people. A 21-year-old convicted at the start of this week. With publishing material, encouraging and providing instructions for people to be terrorists. And I could tell you those stories, not just from the last 2 weeks, but from the last 5 years. So if there should have been a watershed at some of those moments in truth, that they haven't been as visible. You know, clearly the disorder puts those things right in front of people. But this is not a conversation we started in August. This is a conversation we've been engaged in, you know, certainly since the terrible events of 2017 and the way, I mean, really through that decade, but it has felt like the back years of that decade have really accelerated the impact. And you'll have seen that. And I think it is accelerating is our sense. So, yeah, whether it's Online Safety Act 2 or amendments, very difficult for one government to move on its own as well. I think that's the other point about the international nature of this. So clearly, and I would stray way out of my lane, you know, to suggest where, but clearly with so many elections around the world, it's important, you know, to understand the position lots of governments will take.
How concerned are you right now about the risk of state actors, as we often call them, so
like countries,
other countries, trying to spread disinformation and hate here, or to encourage acts of terror, or to inflame existing situations. Are you seeing evidence of that?
We're definitely seeing evidence of it, and in a way which has really shifted in the last five years or so. So it would have been a very small part of our casework, you know, those years ago, maybe 5%. It's about 20% now of the work. And I'm talking really here about spies, saboteurs, assassins and war criminals. And, you know, that sounds quite sort of Le Carrié and sort of potentially remote to a lot of people's lives in the country. But actually what it means is evidence of, and we've got individuals charged in relation to sabotage in the UK linked to the supply chain into Ukraine. We've got individuals charged in relation to spying, effectively. Iranian dissident voices and diaspora community have been clearly at risk of kidnap or assassination. We've investigated over the last couple of years with MI5, the closest partner, over 15 of those cases. We've seen a Iranian journalist stabbed in the UK in the last months. So we're really concerned about the combination of factors, which means that traditional focus we've had on terrorism almost exclusively as our work is definitely shifting, so that we know that there are states who are interested in driving the disinformation because it drives discord, and we see that. But also we see real potential harms here to communities, and of course we've got communities from all over the world as well who are affected by that. So it's a real shift. I mean, in the same way that we have with terrorism, there's enormous opportunity in that for communities to play their part. That means they're having confidence. So we're working really hard to speak to communities and to call out this reality that we know that there have been instances of, in the jargon, it's transnational repression. But, you know, people who've got relatives who are overseas being intimidated here because of threats to their family at home. So it's a growing part of our work. It's a concerning part of our work. We're going to apply the same, you know, fantastic partnership we have with people like MI5 and prosecutors here. You see a lot here, don't you, I watch a few spy movies just to relax, just to keep my hand in. And they're always about turf wars, aren't they? They're always about kind of one agency not speaking to another and people, you know, banging desks. The reality is here, we've got a really strong system, which has helped us bear down on terrorism, not just in recent years, but, you know, across decades. And we're definitely having to apply more of that effort to hostile state actions than ever before.
Which country's the biggest baddie?
I would give you a trio, and I'd stand alongside the Director General of MI5 in this. So, you know, we're definitely concerned about Iran and its aggression, particularly directed at journalists. And dissidents. We're concerned about Russia sabotage campaigns against the supply routes, but also the intimidation of dissident voices. And, you know, tragically, go back to the Salisbury poisonings and other incidents to see the realities of that here. And then, you know, in a very complex world where there are many features to our relationship with China, one of the features is we've had to respond to instance of effectively of influence and attempts at espionage. So it's that trio at the top of our list of concerns. It's not the end of our list of concerns, but it's definitely, it goes back to that point about, you know, whatever happens in the world pulls a thread here, because as the situation in Iran became less stable, you could instantly see the aggression towards journalists here who were giving voice to that rising. And of course, you know, the experience of Russia, Ukraine speaks for itself. So we're in this, I think, with, you know, a global network of partners, but, you know, back here at home with those, you know, really in those close partnerships with MI5, but, you know, fundamentally with communities, really, who, as I've said at a couple of points, have got a great sense of when something isn't right.
When we talk about how these kinds of countries we're describing use social media to fulfill their aims, what does that actually look like to someone who's sitting at home? Like, is it a particular kind of post or a particular kind of video, or is it a little bit more complicated than that? Like, what does that, how does it manifest?
So I think there's a number of things happening. One is just the kind of acceleration by bot factories effectively pumping out and extending the reach of content. There's probably some AI generated content in there as well. We've seen a few examples of that, and definitely some sort of synthetic contents in the mix as well. You see some of those kind of supposed news outlet sites, don't you, or handles on platforms like X, which have got all sorts of different names, but you know, you're only really got to do the Wikipedia search to see perhaps really what sits behind them. So there are sort of sites that are clearly being supported. And then also in the mix, state-backed media. And I guess the state-backed media is the sort of most obvious. We can all spot it, can't we? I won't make myself a friend of Russia Today by saying, you know, but if, you know, Russia Today are saying something, we know, and perhaps, you know, perhaps it's reasonable. We can judge that that is state-backed media. But it's the masquerade of being something else, which is much more sinister, really, and difficult to detect. I think, frankly, I mean, I may be approaching this with a sort of skepticism which you need, and maybe not everyone does, but I think some of these sites really scream out when you actually look at them as not being what they purport to be. Certainly some of the posts on X, you know, you can really see the pattern that's there. I would say, though, if you look at, and I know we talked about Channel 3 now, that didn't look to be...
Yeah, well,
it's the operation of a couple of people, but it looked quite convincing at the first read.
Yeah, and I was just going to say that you know, at the time there were quite a few accusations that that was connected to Russia in some way. The main bit of evidence used to justify that was that it had bought a YouTube channel it was using a YouTube channel rather that previously posted videos that were in Russian and then pivoted to posting stuff that was about Pakistan and then related to Channel 3 Now. And I investigated that because I find that there are lots of people saying, it's Russia, it's China, it's Iran. And it actually sometimes isn't. Yeah. And in that case, I found that it appeared to be a commercial incentive here. Like, I found no evidence to support the idea that it was connected to Russia. And I think that's important too, because if we are pointing the finger when it's not the case, that means that real examples of this stuff can be undermined as well,
yeah,
because people find it hard to figure out what's actually going on.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think there is a reality that there's sort of tolerated criminality in some places, or maybe an inability to deal with that, which might put it in one particular territory or another. But we, you know, we need to be responsible. And I'm not going to dissect or comment on individual cases. It's better in my seat not to do that until we're in the courtrooms, really. But the reality is, you know, we need to be responsible in the way we talk about this. And if we go back to the disorder in the summer, you know, of course there was some turbocharging by algorithms and some turbocharging by bots. All of that was present. You can see it in the numbers and the way the information flowed. But the people who created the content were largely people who were in the UK, certainly the content that we were really focused on. They were real people exposing themselves to real jeopardy by putting those posts out there. So we need to, I mean, one of the things in, you know, we talked a bit about AI and other things. We need to, of course, pursue the novel and the sophisticated and complex, but we also need to recognise in the end, in the middle of all this, there's people. Yeah, we should take care to be measured and clear when we're talking about that. And actually, I do think it's, and again, I'm definitely not saying this just because I'm sat here, but I read a lot of open source intelligence research sites online by people who are into, you know, in the jargon, it's the OSINT, isn't it? But the journalistic community who do that. And I think actually one of the powerful tools, I've talked about moderation by community and moderation by platforms, but actually I do think, you know, there's an enormous part to be played by those people who are out there scouring for mistruth, scouring for disinformation and calling it out, because in the end, that is probably the thing that devalues it most.
I think as well, it's interesting in the context of, I mean, me and you, Adam, have chatted about online trolling abuse before. Like, just people being aware of the impact that all of this can have on individual communities, like during the riots, you know, racism, hate, stuff that got really nasty. And, you know, it was obviously not just about social media, it was about all kinds of other things, but that plays its part. We're then talking about the election and hate around that and the security of MPs and examples of where they've described feeling really unsafe. I, as a journalist, am really lucky to not receive racism, homophobia, other forms of hate, but I do get abuse on a regular basis, including people turning up outside the BBC because of the work I do. Like, this stuff is not limited to the online world. It kind of like feeds back in a lot.
I think it is a really important thing to stress that there's a cost, you know, and there's a cost in a whole host of ways, isn't there? You know, some of that is to people's sense of public safe, you know, of safety. There's safety in public. And some of it is a prosperity risk. You know, if people don't feel safe, so we know that communities recently, Muslim communities, Jewish communities across the last 12 months have not always felt safe and have spoken about that globally. So we need to be, you know, it really does impact. And, you know, I'm definitely not saying this just because I'm in this setting, but the concerns I've expressed around politicians, I would also say in relation to journalists, that if people can't ply this, you know, entirely noble trade,
very kind of you,
certainly, well, certainly necessary, you know, definitely again, if people can't operate without fear that someone's going to post online a picture of them, perhaps their family, you know, maybe they've got kids and where their kids go to school. If you can't enter politics or journalism and feel safeguarded against that, so then we're in a really difficult position. So, I mean, we've been talking, in fact, I was talking earlier today with prosecutors about, you know, the experience of the last weeks and how we roll that forward into, you know, even more focus on that. Some of that's about physical security, but a lot of it is about that sense of security. I wouldn't want to overstate what translates online into the offline. We know there's an enormous amount of, I don't like the phrase keyboard warrior because it's hurtful. What happens is hurtful and still hurts people, doesn't it? But there's a lot of that which stays online. Yeah.
There's a lot of people who won't do anything. They'll post stuff and that's it and they move on.
Yeah.
It's the minority, I guess, we're talking about here, the kind of committed minority. And on that point, actually, I mean, you've mentioned about channels, groups that often have quite sizable membership, but I guess that people choose to go and join because they want to be a part of them. What do you think about algorithms and the way that they can pull in people who would perhaps never have necessarily come across these ideas? Is it fair to say that algorithms can radicalise people?
I mean, there's a really interesting sort of question at the moment about the role of AI in all of this. So if you remember the case of the man who was convicted, he turns up at Windsor on Christmas Day. And, you know, he had developed his own chat bot and was in part sort of attributing his radicalization to his engagement with that chatbot. So at the moment, you know, I can work to get the conviction of Anjan Chowdhury. I'm not sure what we're going to do to achieve the conviction of the chatbot, which in the end isn't really being designed by or controlled by anybody. So the history of our work online has been about finding the publishers and pursuing them. But we're getting further and further away from the idea that a person is creating content. So then we have to step back to who is creating the technology that allows that. I think we're a little way off that being the biggest part of our work. And probably what we see for the most part is the kind of gateway drug open source. So people moving, say, from one of the convictions I could talk about, people moving from an engagement on Instagram to then moving into Telegram to the group gets, and you've dive down a few of these rabbit holes, haven't you? You know, it goes from the sort of opinion to a more extreme opinion to real extremism into the sort of darker conspiracies as you move through. So I think people are doing that as well. But the reality is, It's the echo chamber effect, which means you're just surrounded by like-minded people, like-minded content, which the algorithms are definitely contributing to. I'm not a software engineer. I might not be sat here if I could build a brilliant, safe online platform and market it to billions. But people could do that. And I think that we could have an intervention there. So I definitely think, I don't know what your sense of it is, but I think there is something in the algorithmic push that you get. And you've seen that with boys who just get one form of content. And if you talk to two friends who have got slightly different interests, their feeds on whatever platform they're on are completely different. So
I think that one thing I found recently is that almost everything I investigate comes back to the same thing, which is about the way that recommendation systems, algorithms prioritize engagement over safety. Almost everything comes back to that. So when I talk about young men being pushed violence and hate, when I talk about during the riots, when I was looking at who was sharing this stuff and why, it kind of all comes back to that same thing. The problem with that is that almost all of the major social media sites algorithms operate in that way.
Yeah.
So does this require fundamentally overhauling the way that they work? And is that why we're still talking about this?
I mean, I think you've got to start from the perspective of believing they care. And I think, you know, we do enjoy good relationships with a number of platforms. And I meet people all the time, you know, associated with the industry who leave me feeling like they do care. And I'm not universally, I'm sure there are people I don't meet who would, you know, I'd be less convinced by. I think the challenge is, you know, the whole system is built up on cause and effect, reward, that cycle, hasn't it? And exactly as you say, safety isn't in that cycle at all. So I think there are...
Safety isn't in that cycle at all.
Safety is not valued in the same... that no algorithm is overly concerned with pushing to you the content which is best for your well-being and safety. They're generally looking for some other reaction. You know, and here, you know, definitely you need... you know, you need bigger technical brains to design that, but you can see the consequences of it. And as I say, even personally, you know, if you vaguely pay an interest to one topic, you're endlessly, and I'm not going to advertise the horrible factories for this content by giving them names here, but, you know, because I dwell on them for a few seconds every day at some point, I just get more and more of that content pushed to me. And you know, we're all living in that space, aren't we? So I think there's an enormous amount that can and should be done at the platform end of all of this. And the reality also, platforms need to accept that they are publishers. You know, they're not hands off. They're not without any responsibility.
Just on the point about chatbots, I mean, we know all the big tech companies are developing chatbots, and a lot of people say it's the next big thing. You'll be able to have like a virtual best friend or a virtual career coach or a virtual personal trainer, and it'll be almost like the real thing. Do you think they should pause the development of that technology while they work out how it doesn't end up radicalizing people?
So, I think we, I know.
We know, for example, like Meta, they stopped working on an artificial voice technology because it was too good. Nick Clegg said we stopped doing it because it would have been dangerous to keep going. Yeah.
And as you know, there have been a number of kind of robotics and AI products which have been paused because they just turned out to be horrific racists and misogynists when they launched them, because basically they were consuming, and let's be real, you know, a lot of what people are putting online was being consumed and replicated. So, no, I don't think you should pause that development. I mean, you know, I should also say, I mean, I could talk about the scale of our investigations and the amount of, I mean, the amount of media files we recover. If it weren't for robotics, productivity tools involving AI, we wouldn't get through our work, you know. So the truth of it is we need, you know, we're going to benefit from all of that development. It's a little like secure by design principles elsewhere. So, of course, cars still get stolen now, but fewer cars get stolen, and they get stolen by more sophisticated means. I started my career nearly 30 years ago. You know, a night didn't go by and I don't know whether you can still buy a Vauxhall Corsa, so I don't wish to devalue them.
You're definitely not talking to the right person there.
I can't drive. So.
I don't suppose anyone's buying, anyway, I don't suppose anyone's buying a 30-year-old Vauxhall Corsa, but, you know, if you could, you know, barely a night went by when we weren't chasing a stolen Vauxhall Corsa around the streets of Sheffield. And that doesn't happen now in the same way at all. And that's because industry, governments, made decisions to hardwire safety and security in by design. And you can go to great institutions, you know, those named after people like Alan Turing and others who are working hard in this space to understand how we can maximise the benefit of AI and design in security and safety. So, you know, bigger brains than mine. But, you know, taking that analogy, we've, you know, in our lifetimes, we've seen certain types of crime really impacted by industries and governments making choices. And I suppose my plea is to use the evidence we have. We are still determined. I am hopeful, despite these challenges. We're still going at it every single day to do the casework. But, you know, we're not going to arrest our way out of these challenges. And, you know, we do need that upfront investment in safety.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Now, Mariana, since we had that conversation with the Assistant Commissioner, you have reached out, as the PR people would say, to the two companies that he particularly singled out there, X and Telegram. How did that go?
I reached out to them. I raised the various points that the Assistant Commissioner did, and then other points as well about the role that these sites have played in the spread of disinformation, hate, violence. No response yet, but it is worth saying that Telegram during the riots did say its moderators were actively monitoring the situation and removing channels and posts that contain calls to violence. And they did say that calls to violence are explicitly forbidden by their terms of service. X continues to share in its publicly available guidelines that its priority is protecting and defending the user's voice.
And actually, since we recorded that conversation, Elon Musk has been not invited to the UK's
NFI.
Big... I was trying to avoid that three-letter acronym because one of the words stands for a swear word. Anyway, but fine, if you're more online than me. Yes, so he's been NFI'd to this big investment summit that the UK is hosting, and government sources have let it be known it's because of the stuff he was tweeting about Keir Starmer during the riots.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that struck me so much about our conversation with Matt Jukes is just how willing he was really to talk specifically about the social media companies and specifically about X and specifically about Elon Musk as well. And some of the rhetoric that spread online that he wanted to counter and say, well, hang on a second, we weren't arresting people for their opinions. And, you know, the police have come under criticism for, you know, well, is this the right way of dealing with this kind of thing? Should we be arresting people over their social media posts? What kind of precedent does it set? I've been spending a bit of time checking back in with some of the people I tracked down when the riots were happening, who were involved in spreading disinformation and who said they regretted it, deleted their posts. Those are people who have variously been arrested and then charges were dropped. They weren't ever charged. And it's interesting kind of speaking to them because it reminds me that this can feel a little bit like whack-a-mole. Like there are thousands of those people who posted stuff or who post stuff all the time, hundreds perhaps in the case of the riots. And actually, it makes me think that focusing on the social media companies and how they work, which certainly from the investigations I've done appears to be at the heart of this, is somewhere we should be focusing our attention as journalists rather than just all of the individuals who offer us insights but don't tell us everything.
Whereas my takeaway from the conversation was from the other end of the telescope. And as I was listening to him, I was thinking about my train journey back from the Labour Party conference in Liverpool. And at every stop, you got that see it, say it, sorted counterterrorism message on the train tannoy. And actually, I've now that conversation has converted me on that message. I used to think it was annoying as everyone else did, but actually you realise it's about building resilience amongst the population because the police, the government, the law can only ever do so much. But if you've got everybody dedicating a little bit of their time to doing something, then it's a bit like the COVID lockdowns. Once everyone does the same thing, you have a massive big effect. And so actually it's kind of on everyone to not necessarily police social media, but behave in a responsible way and use the tools that are available. And if that means not promoting or means being more sceptical about stuff that might not be true, or it means calling out things that are not true or pumping out more stuff that is true, then actually that's the way you get the biggest effect. And that's the other end of the scale from new law or new legislation or new crimes or more money to clamp down on things.
And that's how that team he was telling us about works. It relies on the public getting in touch about what they're seeing. And so much of this, I mean, so much of what I do, to be honest, relies on newscasters, other people getting in touch about what they're seeing too, because there's so much on social media, you sort of need to have eyes and ears everywhere. And that's not to say people are being spied on or unfairly monitored at all.
Not East Germany.
No, exactly. It's just that there is a lot of content here. And I think that's when it then again comes back to, well, hang on a second, who's responsible for that content? And that's why big questions are being asked, not just of the people sharing it, but of the social media companies.
Mariana, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again to the Assistant Commissioner for giving us all that time. And thank you to you for listening to this episode of Newscast. There will be another one along very soon.
Newscast.
Newscast from the BBC.
You've come to the end of Newscast. Some people, and you know who I mean, might say you ooze stamina. Can I encourage you to subscribe on BBC Sounds? And you can get in touch with us anytime. Email us at newscast@bbc.co.uk. You can WhatsApp us on 0330 123 9480.
Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the BBC News on 5 Live, I'm Giuliano Casaday. 6 o'clock. The death of the leader of Hezbollah has been described as a historic turning point by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Hassan Nasrallah was killed in an Israeli airstrike on his group's headquarters in the Lebanese capital of Beirut. Mr. Netanyahu said the killing was evidence his country was winning its fight against its enemies.
We settled the score with the one responsible for the murder of countless Israelis and many citizens of other countries, including hundreds of Americans and dozens of French. Nasrallah's elimination is an essential condition to achieve the goals we have set.
The MP, Rosie Duffield, has told the BBC that Sir Keir Starmer's team cares more about greed and power than about making a difference. She's resigned from the Labour Party and will now sit as an independent MP.
We all had our faith in Keir Starmer and a Labour government, and I feel that voters and activists and MPs are being completely laughed at and completely taken for granted.
She's criticised the Prime Minister for accepting tens of thousands of pounds worth of gifts from donors. Downing Street has yet to respond. Three people have been charged with murdering a man who was stabbed in Norwich last week. The body of 19-year-old Calvin Taylor was found in a flat last Saturday. The suspects are due to appear before magistrates tomorrow. The Conservatives' annual party conference starts in Birmingham today, where the focus will be on the party leadership contest. The four candidates will use the conference to argue their case before two more are voted out of the race. SpaceX has launched its mission to bring back two astronauts stranded on the International Space Station since June. The Dragon capsule, which has two empty seats for Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams, lifted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. And Oasis are due to reveal more details tomorrow after a cryptic message appeared on social media. The band posted photos of billboards featuring Noel and Liam with the headline saying, "Be careful what you wish for." Those are the news headlines. James Gregg has your sport now.
Jules, thank you very much. A very good morning to you.